The joint meeting of the Senate Judiciary Policy Committee and the Public Safety Budget Division will come to order. Today is the 21st of January, 2008. And we have on the agenda today a report back to us from the Working Group on Controlled Substances Laws. We put this group together last year, and they've had some quite lively meetings, I understand. And we'll be hearing from Tom Pertler, the Carlton County attorney who was the chair of the working group. And I believe that we have other members of the working group who are here as well. At least I know I've talked to a few of them. And then we have some more information as well. Members, the report is in your packet, as well as the Sentencing Guideline Commission estimated bed impact. And there's also Chapter 152, the Controlled Substances Statute. If there are no other questions, Mr. Pertler, would you come on up and walk us through the report, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, members of the committee, everybody else in attendance, some of my members that were in the group, thank you for showing up today. Appreciate it. Let me just initially, Madam Chair, say that, yes, I'm the Carlton County Attorney and was the chair of this working group that was put together last session. Of course, everybody's well aware of the mandate that we had. There were the six mandatory reporting requirements, as well as a whole host of other optional factors to consider. Some of those factors and items of discussion came up throughout the course of our meetings, but we had a fairly substantial task before us, and we spent our time focusing on the mandate that was directed to us. As you know from looking at the legislation, the mandate, we had a diverse group, and I want to make it real clear that the folks that were part of the working group were both very well-versed in their areas and participated greatly. We had a lot of discussion, a lot of presentation, and everybody contributed to the group. So there was not any dominant factor or sector. It was everybody working together. So I'm real proud of that the group was able to come to some consensus here and make some recommendations to this these committees. The meetings commenced in August, as you're aware, and we had eight sessions. We added one because we were getting close towards the end of our tenure, and we decided that with a little more work, we could come to some recommendations for you folks to consider. I would like to acknowledge the work of the staff. They were very good. You have good people working for you, and they were very good. And at our last meeting, we had a motion recognizing them. So my thanks, and on behalf of the group, thanks to everybody that helped out. It made our job a lot easier, and I certainly appreciate it. So thank you, all of you that helped. There was extensive research. You will see in your appendix. We certainly don't have time to go through all that material, but your appendix includes, for lack of a better word, volumes of materials that was presented to the working group. There were presentations from various individuals with their field of expertise. We had testimony that we took from individuals, from the public, and other groups, as well as much discussion and debate. The report that we have prepared for you, we have, there is some text there, some recommendations, but there is also, as you see, an executive summary that might make it a little bit easier as I just kind of explain some of these items to you. If you take a look, you'll see on the executive summary, we also have included some charts for you. I know if you're like me, it's easier for me to put things in context if I have a chart and I can pan across the chart and go down it and see what exactly transpired with respect to the actual recommendations. The scope was broad, and I want the committee, both committees, to know that we were not able to address or look at and get into depth in a lot of peripheral issues that necessarily come out onto the table when you're talking about the controlled substance laws. We could not attempt to be a fix for a lot of the peripheral issues, but a lot of those things are very important, and there were a lot of discussions and items that we discussed from members of the public, from other members of the group that had very legitimate and important questions, but we had to try to attempt to focus on those areas to come up with some concise recommendations for the legislature. Having that in mind, we did at some length go through those six areas, and for no particular reason as far as pagination or numbers, the first one that we reported on was modifying the threshold amounts, and that was a item that we discussed at length probably right after the first couple of meetings, and we got right into thresholds. We had a couple motions, and I'll get into those in just a bit, but they were on the table, and they were open for discussion throughout the course of the meetings, right up until the very end, when we finally came to consensus vote for some suggestions on legislative changes. The separate sentencing grid that we took a lot of information from the sentencing guidelines. Judge Gomez, before she retired, and of course I want to thank Ann Wall for stepping in. She did a wonderful job, provided us with a lot of good information that was beneficial to us as we deliberated. The consensus early on with respect to a separate sentencing grid was that this was perhaps not the time or place to attempt to add an additional sentencing grid to the ones we already have. And we felt that it was manageable that we could incorporate whatever changes or any suggestions we had for the legislature into our existing sentencing grid. And I do have copies in case anyone is curious, or as we refer to that, or you want to talk about the sentencing guidelines. I did make copies for everybody that I can hand out if that comes up. But the consensus was that we weren't going to tinker with attempting to get a new grid, that we didn't have enough time to try to come up with that sort of a proposal, so we thought we would work it into the existing grid. With respect to additional aggravating factors, and we'll discuss this in further detail as we move through, the additional aggravating factors primarily came into play or were talked about when we were talking about the thresholds and the severity level up on the top, the most severe controlled substance crimes. And it became apparent, at least to me and to others in the group, that it wouldn't be necessary, it may not be manageable to come up with an extra set of factors tacking on to weights of the controlled substance and come up with a kingpin classification that we've referred to throughout the months that we've been working in the group. So ultimately, the working group was unable to reach any sort of a consensus regarding the establishment of some additional factors to consider to enhance the severity level of the crime, the most severe crimes. With respect to maintaining current criminal history score calculations, likewise, the points that an offender has or assigned for prior convictions were determined and are determined by the severity level of that crime. And it was not one of the consensus items of the group that aggravated or changing criminal history scores would be necessary to fit in the controlled substance offenses into our ultimate conclusions and recommendations. So that was left as is. With respect to Section 152.18, commonly referred to as a stay of adjudication, for those of you that may not be familiar with the term, it's a provision that permits, depending upon the individual offender, an opportunity to go through like a deferral so that if they're on probation and they comply with the terms of probation, they can get out of this the pinch they're in without the felony conviction on their record for the controlled substance offense. It is an item that there was great debate on. There was a suggestion that the present law be changed to make a 152.18 disposition presumptive rather than permissive. Right now, the statute is permissive. It allows the courts, it allows the judges to grant a 152.18. And many times, depending upon where you are in the state, that will be used in conjunction with the prosecutor, the county attorney. In other words, the county attorneys may have a plea agreement with the defense attorneys suggesting that this person is the first time they've gotten caught with a controlled substance as a felony amount, and we're going to give them the benefit and get them in and see if they get an assessment and whether or not they would be an appropriate person to get treatment if that's necessary for, you know, if their addiction is a problem for them in their lives, to go through that process and survive probation and successfully not have a felony conviction. So the process works a little bit different around the state. There were some members that were concerned that some counties were not using them, and there was some additional information presented to the group that was contrary to that suggested, despite the numbers that we have, in fact, you'll see in your appendix, I copied in the appendix, there's a reference to the 152.18 statistics. That's at Appendix D in the report. There are some numbers there, but some of those numbers, as it turns out, may not be correct because there are, in fact, county attorneys that were contacted who advised us. They do, in fact, use that sort of a disposition in their counties as well. So ultimately, the decision was to leave the statute as is. It permits the judges to grant that sort of a disposition, a 152.18 disposition, in conjunction with a lot of the different factors, including plea negotiations, and leave it, of course, within the sound discretion of the courts. I would note that we did have some judges on the panel. That was certainly beneficial to us to get a judicial standpoint. And I won't name names, but I think this is fair for me to say that, generally speaking, not just with the judges that were in the group, but judges across the state are, they like to have discretion. And sometimes they get a little uneasy with mandates or mandatory minimums where the legislature tells them what they have to do. And the judges typically like to have some flexibility. And the existing statute, as it is, permits the courts to continue to have that discretion and flexibility to grant those stays when they are appropriate.
Mr. Pertler, just a sec.
Yes.
Senator Letts.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Pertler. I know that judges prefer to have the discretion, but it seems to me that if someone commits an offense 5 feet away from a county line, and they are, as a matter of practice in that county, a first offense anyway, they're going to be able to keep it off, a felony off of their record. They'll get a second chance because that's the way the county operates. But if they're 10 feet away on the other side of the county line, they're going to get a felony on their record if there isn't any difficulty in proving the case up, for example. So the county attorney's back isn't against the wall in terms of negotiating over the claim. I mean, that difference of 10 feet is the difference between a felony on a first offender's record, which will haunt them for life, and not at least the good possibility of never having that felony on their record. And it seems to me that's not really an issue of the kind of typical judicial discretion, especially in the places where the judges aren't bucking the county attorneys and granting Chapter 152 18 dispositions over the objection of county attorneys. I mean, some counties just have, that's the agreement, that it's never done that way. And so it seems to me fundamentally unfair. Now, you're going to find different sentencing and negotiation practices county to county on a whole lot of different things. That's not unusual. But this is pretty consistent across the state in terms of the underlying facts and the underlying behavior and the long-term impact on people with clean records that would otherwise qualify, at least for consideration of this kind of a disposition. I'm having trouble understanding the logic other than wanting to defer to judicial discretion as to why we would continue to allow this disparate treatment across counties for something as fundamental as will you ever get a felony on your record or not.
Mr. Pertler.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator, there was, we had testimony and input from individuals that addressed your concerns, and some of the comments we heard is that it is true that in different parts of the state there are different norms or community sort of moray that their community adheres to. And it is correct that at times, based on sheer numbers of prosecutions and the number of drug cases, it may be a matter of necessity to process and keep things going through the court system. But we had, for example, Jim Crace, one of our police officers, on more than one occasion told us that what happens in his small town, if you had a particular weight amount, that would be a much different community impact than, say, you would see in other bigger cities around the state. So it is true there may be some disparities, but there was also testimony and information that we took that seemed to indicate to us, at least, that there are places in our state and around the state that prefer to have the ability to handle these cases as they see in their county. Now, granted, as I said, it's not just the big bad county attorney who refuses to use this sort of a disposition, but the courts are involved as well. So there's kind of a layered, two-tier safety net or discretionary process involved. So I can't say that is not the case. You're correct. There could be discrepancies, but there was in the minds of some community members, people that are in outlying areas, there was some good rationale from their standpoint as to why they felt it was appropriate and necessary to have the discretion at the local level within their community.
Senator Lass?
Madam Chair, I mean, I appreciate the arguments there, but let me respectfully suggest it's not just a matter of rural counties in greater Minnesota versus metro counties, but even between metro counties, you'll find differences in this. Secondly, I know it's, you know, the judges and the county attorneys tend to have more coordination among themselves about how they'll handle things than if you start than is ever including the defendant or defense counsel side of things. Because I mean, I know personally of meetings that have taken place where the defense counsel may or may not have gotten invited, if you will, or last minute kind of will show up if you're able to kind of thing. And it seems to me, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, do they have 100 kilos of cocaine or not. I mean, you get into the Chapter 152 stuff with a trace of controlled substance on. So if a trace of controlled substance in one county is going to result, unless you've got a defense, it's a different question. But if there aren't any legitimate defenses to the case, it can result in a felony. But a trace one city over across the county line is going to result in a different disposition. Seems to me, especially when you're dealing with addicts, I mean, I'm not talking about getting into this, you know, possessing enough for sale stuff. But when you're dealing with personal use questions, most of the time that's dealing with addicts, especially for, you know, the more serious controlled substances. And it seems to me a whole different range of options ought to be there. Now, presumption does not shut the door. Presumption still leaves discretion in the hands of the bench as well. It just might require some more specific findings or criteria to be met before you overcome the presumption. But it seems to me, and I, frankly, I know a lot of judges resent seeing statutory minimum sentences and all sorts of things. And I think the legislature, as a general matter of practice, ought to leave more room even for getting around those statutory minimums. But that aside, it seems to me presumption in this case would provide some much more fair and consistent practice across the state. For those, we're not talking, not the people that are going to qualify for a 152-18 disposition are the ones that have clean records, that have, you know, very small amounts of any particular controlled substance. They're not out there, you know, selling a ton of stuff out of the back of their van. So it's a relatively narrow group of people, but it's very, very important for those people. And we've had a lot of conversations in our committees about the ability of offenders to reenter into society after they've served a sentence or been convicted of something, and how can they get a job, and how can they get a place to live, you know, with apartment leases and stuff like that. And if we're just putting felonies on every time someone's got a tiny amount of whether it's crack or it's powder or it's meth or whatever, and the first time they've been caught on this stuff, and we're automatically saying you're not getting a second chance, we're going to put a felony on you for life, and you're stuck, you're never going to get an apartment lease in a decent community, you're never going to get a job except for a company that makes it a practice to hire people with felonies on their records because they want to help get people back in the community. We're automatically condemning a whole class of people to the underclass, and I don't think that is productive in the long term for public safety because it's going to leave them with much more stress, a worse position, and back out committing crimes they might not otherwise commit if they had a decent place to live and a decent job.
Mr. Perkins.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator. A couple things come to mind, and I'll just describe for you. I've for probably about 10 years now, I've been, before I was the county attorney, when I was the assistant county attorney, and then as I became the county attorney in 2005, one of my caseloads that I have kept in addition to serious felonies is all the drug cases, so I still prosecute those. And I can tell you personally that I have never had a case where I've said I'm going to stick it to this guy and give him a felony despite it's a trace amount. I routinely use 152.18 dispositions, and I am not of the mindset of, you know, you get a kid who's a first-time offender. I understand that, and I really believe that if that scenario comes up in other parts of the state, I would hope and I believe that those county attorneys would likewise recognize that situation because I certainly am not doing it, and my colleagues in the County Attorneys Association, when I talk to them, at least indicate to me that it is not a scenario that is coming up with frequency where they're just saying absolutely not, this kid who's never been in trouble before, yeah, we're going to go, you know, continue prosecuting and try to give him a felony conviction. So in practice, I'm telling you, I don't do that, and I have not seen that. Secondly, unfortunately, as I indicated just previously in some opening remarks, there are many areas with respect to the controlled substance statutes in our state that have collateral consequences, and we couldn't tackle that. We're aware of it. Everybody's fully aware about housing and jobs, and that's something that perhaps is a different committee, a different scenario. But we didn't we weren't directed to tackle that problem per se, and we certainly are aware of that, and we're not unmindful to it. We understand it, but that is something that again is a collateral consequence question. The third item I would suggest to you is that if we were to suggest a presumption, the difficulty then would have been what sorts of factors do we mandate or do we suggest to the legislature to impose on the judges that would be factors to consider that would rebut the presumption. There's a practical difficulty there as far as what are we going to tell the judges they can and cannot consider with respect to when a person is not going to get the presumption and the judge says, you know, I don't think you're going to, I'm not going to do it despite the presumption because X, Y, and Z. We didn't discuss potential factors because it didn't get to that point, but that would be at least a nuts and bolts pragmatic item that we would have to tackle.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, just one other thing to change the topic a little bit, but along the same theme.
Well, before you change the topic on that, I have a question for Mr. Pertler.
Yes, ma'am.
I know that the working group had a lot of one-vote margin votes on deciding whether to recommend or not recommend. Do you remember the margin on this particular issue?
I believe that was a one-vote margin. In fact, we at a couple of our meetings, we got to the point where we were voting on things multiple times, and for a while there, we were deadlocked at 8-8. And at that point, I said, "Let's just come back in a week or two, and we'll start again." But it is correct, Madam Chair, that there were some of these issues, and you'll see that as you look at some of the minutes will reflect some of those votes. But it
okay.
was close.
Back to Senator Latz. Thank you for letting me ask that.
Oh.
I guess Chair, I didn't ask your permission, did I?
You're the chair, Madam Chair. Along the same theme, we kind of jump past the question of the marijuana grow stuff, unless you plan to come back to that. But I noticed on the chart that's at the front of the report, the recommendation was for no gross misdemeanor under the marijuana grow proposals.
What page are you on, Senator Lance?
Page 6.
We haven't talked much about the marijuana grow proposal at all yet.
But I can hold my question until we come back.
Would you prefer?
Get to that.
That's fine. I'll just open it up, of course, for questions. We'll have perhaps quite a few questions with respect to many of the areas. So it's up to the chair.
Why don't we get through the rest of the main points and then come back and have a full discussion on marijuana growth?
Fair enough.
Mr. Pertler.
The last item you have listed, at least on the executive summary portion of the report, refers to the increased early release for nonviolent drug offenders. That was one of the mandatory criteria that we consider. Again, there was much information presented. You will see in your appendix there is some copied material there for anyone who wants to peruse that. And I would say that as you take a look at our recommendations, one of the things that the group suggested is, you know, the expansion of the program and some criteria that would get perhaps a bigger pool of participants into the program. And it is my recollection that with respect to this item, there was broad support, a near consensus by the group that having been directed by the legislature to consider this question, we looked at it and made some specific recommendations, and I won't repeat them. Everybody has them, and they can read through them themselves. For the increased use and expanded participation in CRP, I have to be perfectly blunt with you and honest with you. We did have some comments and some concerns. In fact, Mr. Christ is here today. He's going to talk about that. The Department of Corrections, he came to us twice, and most recently last Friday, we had him on the agenda first thing because he wanted to convey to us some of the concerns from the department that may arise based on the implications of the suggestions we make. And we certainly we appreciate his comments, and we understand where they're coming from. But having been directed by the legislature to look at this, we did the best we could and said, once it's been established and it is a program that is up and running, is there something that could be suggested or recommended to make perhaps more efficient use? And you'll see that one of the suggestions made by the group, mindful of the fiscal problems, that's an undercurrent here. Everybody understands it, but we understood that if there was any savings to divvy up those savings, 50% back in to the program, another 50% for any local corrections or treatment type facilities, to get those folks who are not necessarily violent criminal offenders, low-level drug offenses that are in prison, perhaps because of a criminal history. They otherwise would not be there based on the severity level of their offense, but they may have a criminal history that mandates that they go to prison. But once in prison, the group believed that if we are to try to tackle this problem and save some beds and try to keep people productive once they get out of prison, it would seem logical and prudent to make these people get the help they need so that they can return to society as productive citizens and hopefully not reoffend. So that was the suggestion that we made, having been directed to look at it by the legislature, to attempt to get more people into the program and better utilize the facilities and even perhaps get some money back to DOC so there could be more counselors, more CD counselors that they could bring on board to get these people the help they need. Because the bottom line is, Senator indicated, there are people that the primary problem in their life is their addiction, and we recognize that. Everybody understood that. We had good professionals from the treatment sector profession, and they had a lot of good information, and they were very, very opinionated and made their point that it's a terrible thing, this addiction, and people that are addicted and have problems with drugs, they're committing, of course, other crimes, property crimes, going in and breaking into garages, burglarizing houses to support their addiction. So if they are low-level offenders, nonviolent folks, and they are in prison, why not attempt to get them the help they need so that this does not become a problem for them after they get out and become hopefully productive citizens in our community? So that is the group's position. And like I said, there was a fairly strong consensus that was something that we were suggesting the legislature take a look at. You do see then also attached we have the reference to the marijuana grow, the thresholds, and the powder thresholds as well. This discussion was at the heart of our deliberations, and we asked the assistance of the sentencing guidelines folks to try to give us some input. Judge Gomez gave us a lot of information, and Ann Wall likewise was very helpful in coming up with some proposed bed impact information for all of you based on the best numbers that she had. And that took a little doing. I want everyone to understand that, we had to get her as many of the cases, 2007 cases that were in existence, so she had a good number to work from. We felt comfortable, based on the high percentage of cases we were able to get to Ms. Wall, that her estimates are pretty good estimates, and she was able to come up with some of those suggestions or estimates for us based on her best practices, and we certainly rely on those numbers that she came up with respect to bed impact information. You'll note in your materials that there were some initial bed impact charts put together, as well as a bed impact estimate based on what we finally recommended for the group. And those are included likewise in the appendix. The first one, of course, the initial impact at Appendix L, and then our Appendix O with the final impact that Ms. Wall was able to come up with based on those thresholds that we passed at the working group. So those were the recommendations that we ultimately were able to provide to the committee, and we hope that they will be some assistance to you as you embark on this path and consider any changes to the controlled substance statutes. I know that there may be and probably will be some ideas, comments, or questions with respect to those thresholds, both marijuana grow or the powder, so I certainly would entertain any comments you may have or questions along those lines.
Mr. Perley, would you explain the marijuana grow, what that's all about? I mean, it's an odd phrase, and I have to admit that until earlier today, I didn't have a clue what y'all were talking about.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Presently, when we're talking about marijuana, they are prosecuted as a possession. I'll skip sale for now because we're not talking about the sale per se. But if a person has in their possession some marijuana, there's a weight amount, and they are prosecuted, of course, based upon the severity level of the offense, depending upon what the weight is of the marijuana. There was much testimony presentation to the group that law enforcement folks from not just the metro area, where it tends to be a big problem, but outside areas as well, outside of the Twin Cities, that there's a real concern that people are growing marijuana, and they may be growing it in large amounts. Of course, when you get to that, it's presumed, of course, that they're growing it for profit to sell it sell it amongst whoever's willing to buy it. And right now, if there's a search warrant that the police conduct and go to a house or a farm or they open up a shed and there's marijuana in there, what they need to do is they need to strip the buds, the leaves, weigh that amount, and see how much marijuana is there for prosecution as possession. There isn't the ability to prosecute individuals because of the cultivation or the growing of the marijuana. And when it was suggested that we adopt a marijuana grow statute, there was broad consensus on that as well, and there was agreement across the board, just about across the board, that this was something we are recommending to the legislature to enact. There was some discussion about actual numbers. Ultimately, we had to put some numbers on the amount, so we came up with the numbers you see as the working group final suggestion. And it is true there was not a gross misdemeanor amount. And I would just comment briefly on that. On more than one occasion, we had people from the community, and specifically even the League of Minnesota Cities, come to us and express their concerns that if we start adopting new levels of offenses, misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, that is going to shift the prosecution of those cases to the city attorneys rather than the county attorneys, because in many areas, what you have is city attorneys, and they're going to get into the business of prosecuting drug offenses that up till now they have not been doing, which would be arguably a burden on the cities, not just the city attorney's office, but the cities themselves. and there was concern about the impact at the local community if we were to start suggesting and enacting misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors to shift that prosecution to their offices rather than the county attorney's office that will do all the felony offenses. So that was in part a driving factor in the determination not to go with a gross misdemeanor grow operation.
Thank you. Are you ready for questions now?
Yes.
Is there some other part that you would like to go on and explain?
Questions be fine. Thank you.
Okay. I'll throw it out. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pertler, I appreciate that explanation on the reason why there's no gross misdemeanor marijuana growth provision. One concern I had, it looks like the choice was between zero plants and one plant. Someone has one plant. It just seems to me that's more of a personal use kind of thing than a for sale thing. And I know that the statute makes a distinction in the different degrees of offenses between sale and the possession that is presumed to be for personal use when it's a small enough amount. So how would you respond to that distinction?
Madam Chair?
Pertler?
Senator, the in fact, in our discussions, we originally did have a proposal that, you know, if you're just growing one plant, you know, one to three, there was one or one to three. There was some suggestion that we include that, you know, right away at a felony level offense. And even some of the folks on my side of the table and the treatment side of the table, the defense attorneys, kind of recognize that that may be an issue. In other words, if someone has one plant, it is at least conceivably arguable that you're growing it for your personal use. Hence, we did not bump them up to a suggested felony level offense until you get up to that the 10 plant. So it was presumed that that may be the case. We don't want to prosecute them with a felony offense if they just have one plant that they're growing and cultivating.
Senator Lance.
So maybe I'm
look up at the next one.
So if they're found with nine plants, then that would not be felony level. Is that what I'm understanding here?
No, I think it's
Mr. Pertler.
That may be correct. Let me just throw in one caveat. If these folks that have nine plants are really good botanists and they've got the lights and the misters and the humidities right and they've got they're growing some BC bud, and these are some really large plants, it may be that the weight of the marijuana on the plant would be such that it would be a felony level possession. So one of the items that we discussed last Friday was that we wanted to make sure that we were clear when we made our suggestions that the two statutes, possession and grow, were not mutually exclusive. In other words, it would allow a prosecution for a felony level amount if you've got some really good stuff and there's a lot of weight there.
Okay. Thank you. I'm much more comfortable now with the proposal now that you've described it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions? If not, thank you. Please stick around, but I think we'll move to Ms. Wall and get information on the bed impacts.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Oh, we don't. Members, you might have caught the fact that Judge Isabel Gomez retired since the last time we were in session. Ms. Wall has taken over, and welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being a part of this working group and
thank
helping
you
with all the information they need and that we need.
Thank you, members of the committee, Madam Chair. I am not taking over for Judge Gomez. I am the senior staff analyst, research analyst for the commission.
Oh,
we have a new director.
Sorry, I misspoke then.
And her name is Sue Allegro, and she is here with me today in the audience. But I'm the one that did the bed impact estimates, so they wanted me to testify. I think you have a separate handout, and it's in the appendices as well. If I could draw your attention to that document.
Is the handout the same as Appendix O or Appendix
yes.
L? Appendix
yes.
O.
This is the final. This is the final impact estimate for the proposal that was adopted. First, I'd like to say that all of these are estimates. They're not firm projections. They're estimates. There's two assumptions we had to make in doing impact estimates. The first is that the future is going to look a lot like the past. So in other words, we expect the number and types of cases to be sentenced in the future to be similar to those that were sentenced in 2007. So if that's not true, then that will throw the impact estimates off. We did, for the first time in 2007, see a slight decline in the number of drug cases sentenced. There a 7% decline between 2006 and 2007. So if that decline in the number of drug cases sentenced should continue into the future, it might actually reduce these bed impacts because there won't be as many beds to be saved. The other assumption we have to make is what do we know about the cases? We had drug amounts on only a few cases, and so we sent out lists to county attorneys of all the first, second, and third degree drug cases, cocaine and meth primarily, but also some of the marijuana cases, and asked them to send us back the information on the drug amounts that were involved. And that was crucial information because we don't routinely collect that. Sometimes when probation officers fill out a worksheet for the sentencing, they will put the drug amount on there. So we had them from some cases, but not enough. And in the end, we ended up getting information on 76% of the first-degree sale cases, 76% of the first-degree possession cases, 72% of the second degree possession cases, 63% of the third degree possession cases. On the sale cases, we got the amounts for about 50% of the cases. So then what I did was assume that the cases that we didn't have amounts for looked like the cases that we did have amounts for, and that's how I would come up with the estimate of how many cases I would move based on what the threshold proposal was. The final combined impact of this proposal is a projected bed savings of 97 beds. The raising the cocaine, meth, and heroin thresholds would reduce in a bed savings of 126 beds. However, the changes to the marijuana sale and possession thresholds will result in a 29-bed increase. That's so we get the total savings of 97 beds. This proposal does not take into account the marijuana grow proposal because I had no information on any cases as to how many cases involved how many plants. So that would further reduce the bed savings if there is any impact from the marijuana grow proposal. Also not taken into effect in count here is expansion of the conditional release program. If that were to save any beds, that would create additional bed savings. And they are recommending some changes to the misdemeanor level penalties, and that wouldn't have any impact on prison beds anyhow. But just to let you know, that could have some local impact. If people move from petty misdemeanors to misdemeanors, that could have some local impact, possibly on jails, but mainly on court processes and processings. It would be a lot more expensive to get the case through the court system. So the summary is on the first page. On the rest of the document, we have more details on where the bed savings are coming from and how many people are moving around and which direction. As far as the bed savings are coming from a total of 19 cases that shift to prison and 19 people that shift to from prison to probation, and then 45 offenders getting shorter sentences. However, the marijuana proposals will result in 8 people moving from probation to prison and 9 people getting longer sentences. So our total is we would have 11 people shifting from probation to prison, from prison to probation. So only 11 offenders who are currently getting prison sentences would be moving to probation caseloads, given the combined effects of the cocaine and the marijuana working in opposite directions.
Great, thank you. Questions for Ms. Wall? Senator?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Ms. Wall. Thank you for being here today. My question relates to the number 5 in the proposal, the section that talks about early release. Mm-hmm. And the conditional
Senator release. Ortman, what page, please?
I'm sorry, we're on pages 14 and 15 in the report.
Thank you.
And the savings that might be appropriated for chemical dependency and also for county correctional or local correctional programs. Is there any estimate anywhere with respect to the recommendations in paragraphs 2 and 5, 2 being expanding the program to allow second and third degree offenders into the program, or 5, allowing for non-drug offenders into the program if they don't present a public safety risk?
No. Madam Chair, members of the committee. I wasn't able to do that. To do that kind of an estimate required that people at the Department of Corrections look at their offender population when they have a firm proposal in front of them and try and figure out, you know, how many more people would qualify for the program. I can't do that because I don't have access to the information of the Department of Corrections has. But they would have to, if this is adopted as legislation, there will be a fiscal note attached to it, and that, at that time they will be able to helpfully provide the numbers of people that might qualify. But I understand that that Mr. Chris is going to testify after me, so he might be able to address that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just to follow up. So the working group did not make any recommendations about how to distribute the local savings, if there is a local savings for those folks. Is that right? There's no recommendation about how to distribute?
Not to my mind. There will not be much local savings, because you're going to have a few people coming out of prison, so that's and then you're going to have people serving shorter sentences in prison. So that neither of those things are likely to result in local savings. In fact, the people coming out of prison would be additional local costs.
Madam Chair, then perhaps you can clarify, because I thought the recommendation was saying, as the legislation currently works, that people would be incarcerated for less time, that the prison bed savings for that would be applied to chemical dependency treatment and or to offset community corrections costs, that there would be a split. That was the recommendation. But no recommendation as to how to distribute those funds.
As far as I know, Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, there was no discussion about that at the working group. But I wasn't in on those deliberations. I just provided the bed estimates.
Well, Madam Chair, to the extent that any of the witnesses might have some suggestions that maybe weren't adopted by the working group, I'd be interested in hearing that.
Okay,
about
great.
What their proposals might be.
We have several people who have signed up to testify, and I know we've got some written information coming as well. So if anybody wants to discuss that, we'd like to hear that. Any other questions for Ms. Wall? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Wall, I'm not sure that you can answer this, but being part of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, I think there's discussion overall about drug crimes and every other crime that you deal with. Did you not just say that there was a 7% reduction in overall drug crime? Is that what you said?
No, offenders sentenced for drug offenses between 2006 and 2007. It declined for the first time in the last 5 years.
Follow up. Is there any thought as to why that is? Any testimony as to why there is getting to be less?
We saw the most decline in the meth offenses, but there was also a decline in the cocaine and marijuana offenses, and the sale of meth decreased. Sentences for the sale of meth declined from, I think, 80 to 88 or something like that to 40. There were only 40 offenders sentenced in 2007 for manufacture of meth. So that number was over 200 3 or 4 years ago, and now it's down to 40. So we have fewer offenders being sentenced for manufacture of methamphetamine. That's one of the reasons. But there are also declines among the other offenses as well.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so is it fair to assume then that what's being done right now is working?
Ms. Wall.
Well, I'd have to consult the law enforcement community about that, but there are fewer people out there, obviously fewer people out there that they're catching manufacturing methamphetamine.
Right. The meth thing I certainly understand, but you're telling me everything else is being...
But there was some decline in both cocaine, methamphetamine cases, sale and possession, and marijuana cases.
Thank you.
Good. Any other questions for Ms. Wall? Oh, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wall, you mentioned that report, you were requiring the amount of drugs, and that was, that's kind of interesting. Is there a correlation between that and the lowering of the sentencing guidelines here? As far as, are you finding for example, on the first degree, that they are carrying more than 10 grams of cocaine or meth? Or is there any...
Okay, let me... If I can direct your attention to page 2 of the impact estimate. These are the proposed... The first is the proposed threshold proposal for possession and sale of cocaine, heroin, and meth. This proposal, the first degree possession cases, the threshold would move from 25 grams to 35 grams. And if you look at table in the middle of the page there, the second table on the page, that means that 33% of the first degree possession cases would drop to second degree. So 33% of the first degree cases had amounts between 25 and 35 grams, and 67% had amounts over 35 grams. So that's the way we use that, the weight information that we had to get on the cases. And then similarly, 29% of the second degree cases under the adopted proposal would move down to third degree because the possession threshold was raised from 6 grams to 10 grams. And 28% of the second degree sale cases would fall to third degree as the sale threshold was raised from 3 grams to 5 grams. So, yeah, now that we have those amounts on the amount information on a good number of cases, I could produce a distribution of the amounts. And it was fairly clear that most of the amounts tended to be towards the lower end because this proposal modestly increases the thresholds, but anywhere from about a third of each of the cases moved down in each of these crimes. So making these modest threshold adjustments resulted in a third of the crimes moving to a lower degree, roughly
a third.
Well,
was there a delineating point where there was an obvious break in that, or was a third just picked out of thin air?
I did do estimates for all of the proposals. I believe it's in Appendix L
on
page 72.
Thank you.
So if we look at and you can see that the bet amounts proposed for the other proposals were much larger, and I'd have to get some other. The other proposals resulted in more people moving, but I don't have it off the top of my head, but yeah, I mean, there were when proposals were made to significantly raise the thresholds, a lot more offenders moved down. There were very few offenders that were qualified, depending on what the threshold was. There were two other proposed threshold levels, and more offenders would move under those proposals.
And just as a point of reference, members, for granulated sugar at least, 1 teaspoon is 4.2 grams.
Madam Chair, what does that mean for a hit, though, as far as usage?
I mean, that I can't tell you in this chart. This is under gourmetsleuth.com.
It's not even a criminal website, right?
I always have trouble, you know, what the heck's a gram, you know?
Yeah,
but
sure.
So it's,
is that
it's
powdered
like,
sugar? Is that powdered sugar?
That was granulated sugar. Powdered sugar
is lighter weight.
1 teaspoon is 2.5 grams.
There you are. Lighter.
So the difference in the types of sugar make a difference, and I don't know which is one is more like cocaine or anything else. So being a neophyte in some of these things. But it's useful to have that little piece of information, I think. Okay, any other questions for Ms. Wall? This has been really fascinating. Thank you. Mr. Turner, can you tell us about the amount of money we save for each bed?
Madam Chair, it's about $25,000. So you're looking at about $2.4 million for 97 beds.
Works for me. Thank you very much.
And I know we have a lot of folks who want to give testimony on the report. And we have lots of paper coming around as well. Why don't we start with Mr. Christ, the Assistant Commissioner at DOC.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members, my name is David Christ. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections wants to go on record today as stating that they are opposed to expanding the conditional release program as suggested by the working group, with all due respect to their consideration and hard work. But we would like to suggest that the challenge incarceration program that already exists in the department meets a similar need. The DOC's base budget was cut a couple of years ago by $1.8 million in anticipation of prison bed savings due to the implementation of the conditional release program. However, so far the department has only realized about $250,000 in savings from that program. Few offenders.
And your next sentence is going to tell us why?
Few offenders committed to prison in Minnesota are considered low risk or nonviolent. Many of the offenders that are sent to prison have had a number of opportunities for treatment previously and other sanctions prior to being sent to prison. Most offenders do not qualify for the conditional release program because of their current or prior offenses or histories of violence. The statute for the conditional release program makes the Commissioner of Corrections the responsible authority to release offenders early from prison if they meet the requirement of the statute in the program. But we're really worried that if one of these guys gets out and commits some sort of violent offense, that blame will be directed at the department, frankly. We think that public safety would be compromised if the legislature weakened eligibility criteria here. And we also are concerned that we don't have enough chemical dependency beds for the offenders that we've got. About 83% of our offenders are assessed as needing treatment, and we're able to accommodate only 34% of them. The proposal states that offenders be admitted to CRP provided they meet criteria and are not a public risk. We submit that the population of Minnesota prisons is highly distilled by the sentencing guidelines, that we lock up people that we're afraid of in Minnesota, not people that we're angry with. And we already have the second lowest per capita incarceration in the country. We've got a very, maybe the highest use of probation and intermediary sanctions already in the country. And we've got a very, very low percentage of our offenders in what we think is appropriate minimum custody units in our department already. So with that, we would propose that the challenge incarceration program that's been in existence since for the past 16 years already fits the role. Many similar types of offenders to the ones that are proposed by the working group are already admitted to the challenge incarceration program. It has an intensive chemical dependency treatment program. It's followed up by intensive supervision in the community and aftercare following release. The CIP program has a very, very good recidivism rate after 3 years. There's approximately 8.8% reconviction and 4.4% reincarceration, which is a very good recidivism rate. And we're sitting there with empty beds in the program right now. We've got about 105 guys in a program that literally has 162 bunks that we would like to fill up. So The other thing I want to take a second to address is the dispersal of funding from the bed savings to corrections for chemical dependency physicians, perhaps, and to the community. That's a tricky thing to anticipate. Either we carve that money out of the department's budget right up front, as happened when CRP started out. Well, we didn't realize those savings, and so very little would be dispersed through that. But the way our population projections are typically done is that the our bed savings through the early release program of CIP is figured into the department's population projections. Then the Department of Finance funds us or proposes funding for an upcoming biennium based on our projections. So we could, I guess what I'm trying to say is that based on that, there might not be any real money to disperse back to the, at least past the biennium. There wouldn't be any real money to disperse to the department or to the community because finance tends not to front us that money and then rely on us to give it back if there's bed savings.
Commissioner Crist, when I last visited the CIP program, it seemed to me that the felony DWI offenders were overrepresented from what I expected them to be there. How many of the 102, is that what you said, people are currently in the program are felony DWI folks?
Madam Chair, there are a good deal of DWI offenders in that program right now. I don't have the exact number for you today.
Can you give me a guesstimate or a guess of a percentage?
I would hate to guess. I can certainly get you a good number.
If you would, please. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Mr. Crist, how many at this time of the people that are incarcerated are also suffering from a severe and persistent mental illness?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I don't have that exact number.
Well, I know it used to be 30% in the male population and about 40% in the female population. And the reason I bring this up is because some subset of that group also is chemically dependent. Because for some people, chemicals are a way of trying to mask the symptoms of mental illness. Now, to me, at least some group of that population are not people that we should be afraid of. They are people that we should be providing treatment to, we should be providing good discharge plans to, and we should be making sure they have good medical coverage when they leave prison. So I'm having a little trouble with your statement that the only people that we incarcerate are people we should be afraid of.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I agree that we should be giving treatment to those people. We should be doing good discharge planning for those people. I don't believe what got them to prison is that they committed crimes and that the presumptive sentences for the crimes that they committed brought them to prison under the guidelines.
Senator Berger?
Madam Chair and Mr. Crist, very oftentimes the difference between person who suffers from severe and persistent mental illness being sent to Anoka State Hospital or being sent to Stillwater is the place that their occurrence took place. If it happened when they were around family and friends, then they're more likely to end up at Anoka. If it happened in a public setting, they are more likely to end up in Stillwater. I mean, and that's just a fact. You can go look at the felony convictions of any group of people that are successfully living in the community with mental illness in supported environments, and you'll find about a third of them have felony convictions from the in the past in their life of living with mental illness. It didn't make them any more dangerous than the person in the next bedroom that never had a felony conviction. They just had more hospitalizations in the bed next to them.
Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chris.
Senator Ortman, I can't hear you.
I'll try and speak up a little
plugged
bit.
Plugged up or what?
Chair. I'm troubled by the fact, and have been for years, that we have 83% of our offenders who need treatment in our facilities, and 34% are receiving accommodations. And I'd like to hear what your proposal is from the Department of Corrections to deal with that disparity, because this is part of our problem, and I think that when you come to this committee and reject these proposals of the working group, you should be offering solutions and not just a clear rejection. What would you suggest we do to start to address that population? And following on what Senator Berglund has said, the whole concept here was that these folks would be considered eligible once they've served half their sentence and would have established that they are no longer a public safety risk. So I think that it's pretty pretty simplistic to say they are all public safety threats at all times that they are incarcerated and they aren't in need of chemical dependency treatment. We need to find a way to get them chemical dependency treatment and move them out if they no longer present a public safety risk once they've been through that program. And by doing that, we can actually save some money and create more chemical dependency beds. I'm hopeful that you'll go back, look at this again, and make recommendations instead of just a flat-out rejection, because there are real issues here that need to be addressed by the Department of Corrections.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, a good number of those individuals that don't get treatment in a therapeutic community in one of our facilities are involved in, if they choose, are involved in some sort of Alcoholics Anonymous, some sort of voluntary program in the facilities. A good number of those individuals that don't get treatment in our facilities are directed to some sort of treatment in the community as a condition of their release. And so the department is addressing that for reasons of public safety. I'll let it go at that.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, just one follow-up comment. We have folks incarcerated. They're spending months, if not years, in jail, in prison, and there's nothing we're doing to address the underlying problem, which is chemical dependency. And so we're going to let them wait until they get out before they can participate in a community program, or maybe it might be available to them while they're in there, but we should be putting together chemical dependency programs to address the heart of this issue. And I'd like to see the Department of Corrections come up with a proposal to do that. If not this one, then what?
Senator Foley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, I too am concerned about the presence of folks in, that are mentally ill, that are in penal institutions. I'd like to know what numbers there are that are dual diagnosed, if you will. And so you've got these folks at the same time. You've got schizophrenia and alcoholism, perhaps.
It'd be good to know. I think that'd be an important piece of information for our committee. Is there some way that DOC can find that out for us?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was distracted.
I didn't
hear the question.
Senator Foley was asking whether we could find out how many of the offenders have a dual diagnosis of a chemical problem as well as a
mental illness.
And Madam Chair, a mental illness and a diagnosis of chemical dependency?
Yes, a dual diagnosis.
Yes, ma'am. We'll look into that.
And get that information for us. Okay. Somebody over here had their hands up.
Yes,
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would venture to say that's very high, actually, Senator Rosen. Probably close to 90%. But my question, Assistant Commissioner, is just a minute. I just lost it.
You lost it?
Yeah.
Okay, you think. We'll go to Senator Ingebrigtsen and come back when you catch it again.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
My brain's fried, so I know.
Maybe I'm a little confused, but would it be the Department of Corrections' responsibility to know whether these people are mentally ill when they're turned over to them, or would that be the responsibility of the charging agency to look into that?
Courts.
Or the courts.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we do assessments upon intake to our facility to determine whether our offenders are mentally ill or chemically dependent. So we determine that.
Okay, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. And a follow-up, when you talk about treatment that's allowed in the prison system, are there some of these offenders that are offered this that just simply won't do it?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes.
What number are we talking about there?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I can attempt to find that out.
Okay. Another good piece of information for us. Senator Rosa.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll get it out before I forget it. Assistant Commissioner, you mentioned that a third of your beds are going unused at the Challenge Incarceration program. Can you review again why you have close to 57 beds that aren't being utilized right now? And obviously that is a cost drain on the state.
It's a waste of money.
It's a waste of money, yeah. So I didn't understand that.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, those beds very recently came online, and we are attempting to tweak the criteria for the Challenge Incarceration Program to fill those beds. We agree that it's a drain of resources and we want them full. But we want to make sure that we're ensuring public safety at the same time as we're filling those beds.
Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen,
could you explain, Assistant Commissioner, what tweaking means? I know what tweaking means in the drug world, but what do you have to do? Are you changing your set of requirements, or is it something that has to be mandated from the state? Or?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we are looking at the criteria, the internal criteria for the Department of Corrections, and trying to expand that criteria to allow more folks to enter the Challenge Incarceration Program, again, consistent with public safety.
And members, I just got a note from Barbara Cox at the DOC. She knew the answer of the number of folks in CIP that have felony DWI as their governing offense. And of the 88 offenders in the program, 34 are felony DWI folks. So 40%, more or less.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen?
I'm still confused. What area are you going to be going at to make sure that we can open up, get offenders into this program?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, for instance, we had a criteria that was tied to the number of felonies that a person has in their background. And instead of tying it to the felonies, we're now tying the eligibility to their criminal history score. Now, the criminal history score from the sentencing guidelines worksheet takes into account prior felonies, but it also takes into account a decay factor. So if some of those felonies are, say, older than 10 years and don't get counted toward the way a person is sentenced to prison in the first place, then we thought we shouldn't be counting those felonies toward a guy's eligibility to the Challenge Incarceration Program. So that's one example of how we're expanding the eligibility.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess in the area that I spoke on before and where Senator Berglund did, that I'm fearful of the number of people that have mental illness and are incarcerated in jails and prisons. And I might point out that the leading one in the United States is Rikers in New York, and the second one is the Los Angeles jail, and the third has Cook County, Illinois. So those three entities have have the large amounts of mentally ill people incarcerated, and so some of those, or all of those, at some point or another, are going to go out on the street, and are we really prepared to examine them and treat them and move forth when they're still in prison?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, we do our absolute best to identify mentally ill offenders when they come into the facility, and we're constantly assessing behaviors that might emerge that perhaps we missed at the intake and offer treatment to those offenders. We've got a spectrum of behavioral health options available to us, from housing offenders in our mental health unit 24/7, where they get very intensive treatment, both psychotherapy and drug treatment, if they're willing participants of that. Every once in a while, someone in that group will give us reason to go to the courts and ask that they be forced to take medication. That doesn't happen very often. And then we've got a number of step-down mental health treatment options to us in the department, from meeting with counselors on a regular basis to living in supportive living units where they're more or less general population, but they have to be reminded to take care of daily activities such as bathing and cleaning their rooms, their cells, things like that. And then all of this lends itself to a program for release. When these individuals who are on our behavioral health radar are nearing release, we've got mental health release planners that can tie these offenders into resources in the community. They can make sure that they've got a prescription for their psychotropic meds when they leave the facility, and perhaps set up an appointment for them with a mental health professional on the streets who can renew that prescription. So we do our best to transition these folks into the community with a plan that is going to give them a fighting chance of not coming back to prison.
Members, I'm starting to realize that this is a subject that we need to talk much more in depth about, but we do have before us the report that a lot of people spent an awful lot of time on. So I think at this point we will move on to other people who were on the working group and get their comments and testimony. Ms. Soyford is passing around some information about folks who were incarcerated in 2008, and it looks like 90% were diagnosed as chemically abusive or dependent, and 80% were directed to treatment. So we will be having more discussions about this as we try to figure out budget issues and policies that basically we're the policymakers for. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much for your help. Mr. Stewart from the Public Defender's Office. This is just amazing information if you've had a chance to look at these bullets. And remember that in your packets there is a save folder for anything that you want to continue to have at meetings as we go throughout the session. And if you put things in the save folder, they just stay there for your use on upcoming meetings. So you want to put any of this in there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
It just occurs to me, all three Lindas who are senators are in this hearing today. Wow. Senator Scheid.
Some of you
going to
change
it's,
your name.
It can
so
be
no
confusing. Yeah. It can be confusing. Some people might think there are too many of us, but I've...
Never.
And my question is about this, the treatment fast facts. Are these newly committed offenders, is that all offenders, or is that... drug and controlled substance offenders, or which offenders? I mean, I don't know the numbers, so maybe it's a naive question.
Ms. Cox?
All offenders.
That, Madam Chair, that means that they are not all, they weren't there for drug or controlled substance crimes necessarily.
Everything.
It's all things. Okay, thank you. That helps.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Stewart, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the Minnesota State Public Defender. I was part of the working group, and I'd like to say I think we got some good things done, particularly in regard to recommending an expansion of the early release program that the Department of Corrections has some qualms about. But I'd like to spend a couple minutes with you talking about three things that we were not able to get done that I would like to suggest to you as some alternatives to some of the recommendations that are in the report. As you know, the working group was very closely divided on a lot of things. And so a couple of items that I think were important were not included in the final set of recommendations. I'd like to begin with the recommendation that is nowhere in the report that you should consider repealing Minnesota Statute 152.025, Subdivision 3B.
Say that number again, please.
152.025, Subdivision 3B. This provides for a fifth-degree controlled substance crime, a mandatory 6 months in jail if it's a second or subsequent offense. This proposal to repeal this came up on a motion in the working group and was defeated on a vote of 8-8, which is how close that one was. And interestingly, a lot of the people who were opposed to the expansion of 152.18 on the basis that they wanted to preserve judicial discretion felt that this mandatory directive to the trial courts was a good thing, and so they voted against the motion. I've passed out a one-page Court of Appeals opinion that came down last month, December 9th. It's the State of Minnesota versus Linda Marie Cobb that just illustrates one of these cases. Ms. Cobb was convicted on a trace element second offense, and the trial judge did not give her the 6 months in jail. The county attorney appealed, and the Court of Appeals said that they would have to give her the 6 months in jail. However, at the bottom of the right-hand column, if you see see this Court of Appeals opinion, the court quotes that they're troubled by this approach. They say that even though a person accused of a drug-related crime does everything asked of her by the criminal justice system to rehabilitate herself, the law in terms of minimum sentencing treats her the same as if she had not rehabilitated herself. At a time when our prisons are full and Minnesota has a severe budget shortfall, the rehabilitative achievements of some of our many drug offenders must be taken into account in executing sentences. In the final line at the bottom of the page, the court says, in light of the unnecessarily harsh result in this case, we urge the legislature to re-examine its approach. You could take that line out of 152.025, and then the court would have the discretion about how much jail time to impose rather than to have the mandatory 6 months. This woman in this particular case had been clean of drugs for 2.5 years. By the time her case was resolved, which is why the judge did what he did, but now she has to do the 6 months in jail. So you could, that's a problem that we were unable to solve in this task force. Secondly, if I may, I'd like to comment briefly
on... Mr. Stewart, just a second.
Sure.
Just on that case, Mr. Stewart.
Sure.
Has this been appealed?
The question, Senator Ortman, was
what? Has it been appealed?
Has it been appealed? Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman... I don't know. The Supreme Court previously said it was within the legislature's power to make this a mandatory sentence. So under current law, the legal issue in the courts isn't very good. I mean, I don't think this woman would get relief by trying to go to the Supreme Court because the law is clear that this is mandatory.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Stewart.
if the legislature were to decide that we wanted to quickly repeal this law, just as a recommendation from the courts and a way to address some budget savings, would that have any impact on people who've already been sentenced under this law, or would it only apply prospectively?
Mr. Stewart?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think it would only apply prospectively because by the time you would do that, the people that were serving the 6 months would be pretty near done with the 6 months. I mean, if you started today, it would be hard to get an effective date that would help this woman, for instance, who had to start serving the 6 months in December.
And this would be served in the county jail because it's less than a year. Do I remember that right?
Madam Chair, that's right. Although I believe the provision says in the alternative you can send them to prison. And this particular woman is going to the county jail in Dakota County. So that's something we were not able to take care of. As I say, it was an 8-8 vote where this failed to move this to you.
Okay. And Senator Latz.
Mr. Stewart's comment on statutory minimums required by the state and its impact within the working group suggests to me that the statute, the ratchet is a one-way ratchet. When the discretion or when the state would want to impose a requirement that there be a presumptive disposition that would not require a felony, a reduction in punitive consequences, that tends to be rejected. But where it would be an increase in punishment or punitive consequences, which, of course, is much more popular politically and is harder for the public to understand, that's perfectly acceptable. And that's how these laws over years and years of years in the legislature just get ratcheted higher and higher and higher because it's so difficult for legislators to vote to reduce sentences, but it's great to introduce bills and vote for sentences that are increased and are more punishment. There's a chart that was handed out to us, and it doesn't say by whom, but there are three graphs on here. At least all the members at the table should have this. Comparing Minnesota with other states. And if you take the figure 6 on the page that only has one graph, you'll see the presumptive sentencing lengths. We are three times more severe than Texas.
You take people out back and plug them.
If you look at the other charts, Minnesota is higher than all of is more punitive than all of the other states in the comparison group, many of which I would presume would have been quite punitive, including Texas. So I'm at a loss to understand how the working group could not find some way to loosen up these statutes a little bit.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that.
One that jumps out at me, Senator Latz, is the thresholds for the most serious sales and just what a big disparity between Minnesota and Iowa, for example, for meth.
Oh, my goodness.
So, thank you. Mr. Stewart, you had two more recommendations.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You said we're not part of the recommendations.
Might I just address Senator Latz for a moment?
Yeah, sure.
Those charts are out of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission report on drug offender sentencing issues from January 31st, 2007. Well, that's a good report to take a look at all the way through. There are a lot of things in there that might surprise you. Madam Chair, the second thing I wanted to mention has been discussed. It's the attempt to make Minnesota Statute 152.18 presumptive. Now, if you look at the 87 counties, there are some counties like Hennepin County where I live where there's a drug diversion program and there's a drug court and there's frequent use made of 152.18 dispositions.
Okay. That's the Mr. Stewart, just a sec.
Sure.
Members, in your packet is Chapter 152, so you can see what we're doing. The section that we just discussed is on page 22, and Mr. Stewart is now talking about 152.18.
just toward the back somewhere. Page 52. Mm-hmm. Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's also a report from Janet Marshall from the State Court Administrator's Office in there, which is 3 pages. It's in Appendix D, and it's also been handed out to you separately. Mm-hmm. Some of the county attorneys feel that these numbers are wrong. I've talked with Ms. Marshall about 15218 numbers several times, and I feel that she's pretty reliable when she signs her name to a report. I think it's interesting how many counties here, out of the ones surveyed, showed only one use of 15218 in the course of a year. There are also some discrepancies that seem kind of strange. For example, Otter Tail County had 14. But Clay County, where the county seat is Moorhead, only had 3. Pine County had 30 of these, but Anoka County, which is much larger, only had 26. So I mention this because this is an area where the legislature might impart a little more consistency to how these cases are sentenced. And I would submit respectfully that really the state has nothing to lose by giving a person this chance on 15218. If they successfully clean up their act, they're rewarded by not having a conviction. If they mess up, they're convicted, they get a whole line of consequences, including maybe prison. So it really isn't something where people would have a lot to lose. I would add that although it would impact judicial discretion a little bit, all 3 of the judges on the working group voted to have 15218 become presumptive. And you'll see in the report there's an area called third proposal. That third proposal was written by the judges, and you'll see in writing that they endorsed making 15218 presumptive. Last year you had a bill that had a lot of provisions in it that would do this. It was Senate File 2790, and the language that would take care of 15218 was the Section 1 of last year's Senate File 2790. Finally, Madam Chair, if I may, one third thing, and this is what led me to pass out a copy of the sentencing guidelines grid on one side, and on the other side, the BCA drug price survey results, is I think that these two graphs make kind of a striking comparison. If you look at the sentencing guidelines grid, this states the presumed sentences for felonies in Minnesota. If you look over on the left-hand side, at Roman numeral 9 in the zero column of criminal history score, kind of right above the dark area, you'll see controlled substance crime, the presumed sentence is 86 months. Okay, and right below that, the controlled substance crime second degree, the presumed sentence is 48 months. Well, what does that mean? Right now, with the threshold at 25 grams for possession, that's less than an ounce of cocaine. And if you flip over to the BCA chart on the back of the grid, you see an ounce of cocaine is worth $1,170. So you're talking about putting a person in prison for 7 years for possession of $1,170 worth of cocaine. That's the same sentence that you get for manslaughter in the first degree or assault in the first degree and many of the criminal sexual conduct crimes. That's $1,170 worth of cocaine, Madam Chair. Similarly, the 48-month level, that's a 4-year prison sentence for selling 3 grams or possession of 6 grams. Now, the
two tablespoons now.
Right. The working group, by a very close vote, adopted the law enforcement proposal that it would increase those thresholds from the one from 25 to 35 and increase slightly the ones in second degree. But, you know, I was just sitting with my friend back here talking about what else is on that line with second degree. Arson in the first degree is the same level crime as the possession of 6 grams of cocaine right now. Arson in the first degree involves burning down houses with people in them. And if you have 6 grams of cocaine, you're in that same box. I think just about any citizen in Minnesota, if they looked at that, they would go, what the heck are we doing? Madam Chair, I leave you with that. I want to say there was one other factual controversy that we had. We could not agree on whether or not the Department of Corrections was projecting an increased need for beds every year. And so I went to their presentation over in the other body last week, and they are projecting 200 additional beds being needed each year. So if you were to implement the recommendations that are in the report now, you would be taking care of less than half of the projected increase in the need for beds. And I respectfully and sincerely submit to you that that seems to me to be too modest. The judges recommended a proposal where the threshold would go to 100 grams, for instance. But the working group proposal that you've got here is for 35 grams. And so ultimately this is your call, but it seems to me that to invest $25,000 a year to give somebody an 86-month sentence for possession of $1,170 of cocaine, you could question the public value in that. Are we really getting our money's worth as a society if we do that?
Questions for Mr. Stewart. Senator Scheid.
Forgive me, Mr. Stewart, you may not be the person who knows the answer to this, and I think somebody's asked, maybe Senator Rosen earlier, but I can picture an ounce dry substance, and what can you do with an ounce of cocaine? You know, how many people share in that? Is that what would an ounce be used for? How would it be consumed or used up?
Mr. Stewart?
Madam Chair, you know, and Senator Scheid, typical users would use several grams in a weekend. A gram is about the amount of volume that would be in a pink packet of Sweet and Low that people put in their tea. And several grams would go into a chemically dependent person in a weekend. And an ounce is 28 grams.
Okay.
So if a person is selling 3 grams to become a second-degree offender, that's not very much in the world of usage of this drug. It's not like, for instance, LSD, where 3 grams would be a whole lot. There are people here that know much more about this than me. I think Tim O'Malley was here and Michael Campion, and they could tell you a lot more about this. But
as other people come
Chair,
up to
thank
the,
you.
The
just
table
curious.
Who know yeah. more about this, if you just give us some information, that'd be great. Senator Berglund, did you have a question before? And I just went on by?
No. I just wanted for people that don't serve on the Health and Human Services Budget Division to know that people that are committed because they're mentally ill to the Commissioner of Human Services in a majority of our facilities in Minnesota today are there for an average of 20 days. After 20 days, they're no longer considered a danger to themselves or others. I just wanted to make that statement in regard to, you know, needing to be afraid.
Okay, good. Senator Lance?
Mr. Stewart's here.
$300 a piece.
I asked for your comment. I looked at the makeup of this
working group. It seems to me so often the decisions that you get are dependent upon who's making the decisions.
PCA's deal.
Count 7 law enforcement members on this group. We include representatives of prosecuting attorneys' offices, sheriff's departments. There's been talk about 8-8 votes and voting in blocks. Is that consistent with my analysis of just the sheer numbers, consistent with the voting blocks that you were observing?
Mr. Stewart?
Madam Chair, Senator Letts, I want to preface this by saying that I think people brought a lot of deep beliefs and sincerity and honesty to this working group.
Sure.
So I'm not here to impugn the motives of anybody.
Nor am I.
But I will say there was a group of people that were talking about alternatives and greater bed savings. And there was another group of people that were talking about it's good to get these guys off the street. So that's kind of how it broke down. The community members were sort of split in that regard. But if you look at the thing that is called the third proposal here, I believe that is, it would be I maybe in your packet. That proposal was put together by the three judges. I'm sorry, it's K. Excuse me.
Page 69.
The third proposal on page 69, that was put together by the three judges and by Tom Atkins, the head of the Washington County Corrections Department. And I think that proposal got, most of the provisions of that proposal got 7 votes, but they didn't get 8 or 9. So that's why we're in the posture that we are here today. That's the proposal you could call the judge's proposal. In fact, the commission, the task force voted to call it the judge's proposal.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stewart, I'm really interested in the comment that I think I read here, and I think maybe, you, if I'm not mistaken, you made reference to that, talked about using some different criteria or having a little more latitude based on how involved someone is in a criminal enterprise. And I guess, you know, I just think about, I remember reading in my local paper in Bemidji about a Cass County case where some people had come up from Mexico, and the resolution of that case sounded like a pretty serious drug-related case is that they were deported. And I thought, well, a lot of good that's likely to do, you know, in terms of preventing things from happening in the future. But at the same time, when we're just talking about determining the level of criminality by things like weight, we may be picking up people who are really not that hardened or making a lot of money. Maybe they're just transporting or whatever. There's reference in the report to that. And I think that somehow is a more important factor than simply looking at weight. And yet I know it would be a lot more complicated to determine, you know, how you're going to prosecute and make those determinations, maybe more expensive in terms of the prosecution if you're looking at things like motives or factors like that. But it does disturb me that we're just have so little flexibility in the system. And then with regard to that, the point, the second question I have is regard to the point you made about the probation before conviction. I'm just looking at my district, and I see that in 3 counties we only had this option utilized once, but in Crow Wing County it was utilized 33 times. So that's just a huge disparity. And is that being driven by judicial decisions? Is it a prosecutor's attitude toward, you know, which way to go? And is there anything in terms of budgeting, whose budget it comes out of, that has any factoring? I mean, is there any difference there?
Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, let me start with the comment about determining degrees based on weight. I completely agree with you. We proposed some factors that would have included things like, did the offender have a weapon? Did the offender employ other people in the drug trade? Did the offender use juveniles to be part of the operation? To me, things like that would be more probative of criminality than the actual weight, because as you point out, sometimes the people that transport are the lowest folks in the drug hierarchy. You know, in the TV crime shows, they're called mules. You know, and meanwhile, the mastermind is in the back room carrying no weight at all, but really kind of running the thing. So I agree with you about weight. Secondly, I was kind of surprised to see the difference between Crow Wing and Beltrami County in that chart by Janet Marshall. I think that a culture develops from the interaction of the prosecutors and the judges. And maybe it's a good thing in some ways to have local sentiments considered. But if it were made a presumption, then at least that would start the conversation about each case. People would be saying, why shouldn't we give this person 152.18 rather than saying we don't do that here? That, I think, would be very, very helpful. As for the budget, I'm not sure what the fiscal impact is, really, of 152.18, except that the person that doesn't get the benefit of that gets the felony conviction, and they have the disabilities with respect to employment and housing and so on. So, to me, to make this presumptive is not something where there's much of a downside to anybody. If the person succeeds, great. If they don't succeed, then all the possible weight of the law is still right there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. I know Mike Freeman wanted to speak, and then we've got Brock Hunter who wants to speak, and I think Dan Kane I would like to hear from as well. And we have about a half hour. So, Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair.
Go right ahead, please.
Madam Chair, thank you. It's always great to be back in the Minnesota Senate. And let me try to cut right to the chase, because a number of questions, and I primarily want to provide a little different additional information on a couple of topics. Senator Latch, you asked about 152.18, and you talked about 5 feet inside one border, one county, just as in 5 feet inside one state. First off, I need to correct Janet Marshall was working for the courts back in the dark ages when I was here, Senators, and she's a fine person. The problem is what we found out in calling actual clerks of court, judges, and county attorneys in some of these counties is that they didn't record it right. It's hard for the person collecting the data to report it correctly if what he or she gets isn't good data. We can show that in a number of these counties, 152.18s were done. I need to tell you that a 152.18 is a first-time diversion. That means the first time a person comes in, they can be diverted under this either at the request and the urging of the prosecutor or urging of the judge. Lots of counties don't get very many drug cases. Clearwater County had one case last year, and it wasn't eligible. Cottonwood County had 4 drug dispositions. One was a 52-18, one was a long-term prison, and 2 other had long-term criminal histories, something 152-18 wouldn't make sense. And I can go on and on. Isanti County, they've had the county attorney. I've offered them at times, and our judges have given them at times at straight pleas. So let me put it this way. If a person has a limited amount of drugs, the county attorneys and the judges know the cost of prison. When you talk to the Department of Corrections people with the boot camp, the challenge incarceration, and with CRP, there simply aren't very many people in 2008 who went to prison who were non-violent, low-level offenders. We simply don't send them. We simply don't send them until it's the second, third, fourth, or fifth time. In Hennepin County, we divert almost every first-time case, And then they come in the second time, and then we give them a 150-218. Now, the numbers in 207 are not very good numbers. We had a lot of troubles with our drug court. But thanks to your former colleague, Senator Jane Ranum, now judge, it's really hard. People, you got to call them Senator Judge or Judge Senator. But Senator Ranum and Gail Baez, a longtime veteran prosecutor, did an excellent job, along with Judge Barnett, who is part of this. First time, almost always we give diversion. Second time, we almost always give 150-218. And the third time, if the person comes in and shows through this study that they are high likelihood to reoffend and high likely they're an addict, they go into this very intensified drug court provision. We've heard a lot from the courts that we're going to have to do away with drug courts. They're too expensive. Senators, I'm telling you, its programs, if done right, work very well. And it's cheaper to have a drug court and to work with these people there than send them to prison. There simply aren't very many people, as I said, in prison that really will benefit from either the boot camp or the CRP program. So the 152.18 was kind of a myth. The change can be made. It won't change my work in Hennepin County. It won't change work in most counties. So I don't think it provides very much. Secondly, someone asked a very good question about marijuana grow. Why are we doing this? It's new. What's the problem with marijuana grow is even in great places like South Minneapolis, you will find somebody buys or rents a house and puts in a basement, and all of a sudden the water bill goes way up and the electrical bill goes way up. It's hydroponic marijuana plants being grown. If you go in early and they're little tiny plants, the only thing we got now is weight. We frankly, a lot of times, won't even be a misdemeanor. But if they have a ball, which all of us who garden a little bit know when you've got some roots here, that counts. And it's 10 plants. That's what the threshold commission came. 10 plants. We need a marijuana grow. Why did we need a marijuana grow, and why did we feel we needed to lower some of the marijuana thresholds, members? We did it because there were 48 homicides in Hennepin County last year. Over 60% of them were done by juveniles, and most of them had something to do with drugs, and most of the time it was marijuana. This is not the marijuana of Senator Scheid's in my college years. I said college years, Senator. I didn't say that you were using. Yeah, certainly my years. Yeah. This is different stuff, and all the drug cops will tell you this is different stuff. Now? Much more high potency. One joint will lit up a whole room. Okay, and that's a real problem. And we find so many, even when it isn't a homicide, first degree assaults, drive by shootings, almost more from marijuana than it is from crack cocaine now today in the city of Minneapolis and elsewhere. And my general, though not scientific, discussion with other urban colleagues finds that marijuana is a big problem. I think the group did a good job with that. On the CRP program, I have great respect for David Christie. He's a fine criminologist. We think that, and in discussions with then-Senator, now-Judge Neville, I don't think the Department of Corrections really wanted to have the CRP program thrust upon them. Sometimes we have to assist folks with seeing the light of day. But unfortunately, the department did, as lots of folks will do, put up a lot of roadblocks. One of the things that the Threshold Commission did that I'm most proud of is try to break some of those down. With the right person that's nonviolent, a second or three degree salesperson shouldn't be excluded from this. We ought to assess the person when they show up at prison and not what they had 3, 6, 9 months before. We ought to include and make eligible for this program people who come in for other crimes that weren't drug-related if, in fact, they're truly chemically dependent. Why am I excited about this program? You get a person in, and you give them a chance to cut down their sentence, and this is the inducement to go to chemical dependency treatment. Now, all of us have known people on the outside and loved ones many times. You just can't get them there until something really significant happens. Threatening loss of spouse, family, all sorts of things. And all of a sudden, the light hits. Well, sometimes when the door closes at Stillwater State Prison, which, as you all know, is not a very nice place to be, all of a sudden they start seeing the light of day. But one of the provisions is if you go in this program and you don't make it, and we know people don't make it sometimes, you got to go make up the time. You go back out and have to stay longer. That doesn't make good sense to us. Now, I don't claim to be a chemical dependency counselor or administrator, and I'm certainly not a peniologist. But I'm suggesting to you some of these things. I meant criminologist, I'm sorry, peniologist. I'm thinking that some of these programs, ideas came forth from the Threshold Commission, who wanted to induce some discussion. And I really urge this committee, as they have really serious conversations, I would really like every person who is addicted that's in prison to have a chance. Because I'd like to do it, not just because I'm altruistic and wonderful, but we can cut those sentences in half. That saves money. That saves more beds than anything else. Members, in terms of voting blocks, you know, you all been here before. You know, there's a lot of things that passes out here. 10 to 9, 11 to 7, that's what happens. Consistently, the voting block were 5 law enforcement, 3 cops, 2 prosecutors, and the 3 community members, 3 of the 4 community members who came. Because Melanie Majors from South Minneapolis is concerned about crime in her neighborhood. And when we talked with her about why we thought we ought to raise first-degree possession amounts by 40%, which the law enforcement proposal and the threshold commissions did, or second-degree possession by 67%, or sale by 60%, she balked at that. She said, that's too much. And we talked with her, and how did we come up with those amounts? It wasn't willy-nilly. We met with a group of people across the state, prosecutors, and drug enforcement people, and said, we need to make some changes. And we talked to DOC, and we learned who's there. And we saw the number of people in the department, in the prisons are down, and the drug folks are down. And we talked about the departures. And we, frankly, in those thresholds, pushed it about as far as we think public safety will permit. Now, the overall outcome is the savings of 100 beds. Now, folks, we've all seen fiscal notes, and we've seen bed impacts. It's not an exact science. And Walls worked very closely with us. We believe that you all asked us to look through to make some modifications and save some beds within the guise of public safety, with the concept of doing that. We think we did that. And I would urge members to look at this proposal as a whole, look at the people who were there. I'm pleased that Phil Cohen, longtime former mayor of Brooklyn Center, is here. Dan Kane, a longtime treatment professional. Mr. Stewart, Brock Hunter is here. Tom Pertler and I. Bob Bushman, long, well-known police officer in NARC, is here who helped. We think that these were the levels that made some sense. And like everywhere else, like you all meeting, we had some challenges, we had some debates. We think we met the challenge that you asked us to do. And I would urge you to look at it as its whole. I'll stand. Is there any questions, Madam Chair?
Questions for Mr. Freeman? Senator Parisel.
I just have a comment. I don't think you're the real Mike Freeman. The real Mike Freeman used to come with a pack this thick of stuff that he put on the table every time he came to a committee. He was just carrying it around to look
there important.
There it is. Our absolutely distinguished former colleague, Senator Perforce, said about Senator Knack and I, the trouble with those young men, they carry too many papers and act like lawyers. I listened to Senator Perforce.
Senator Bergman.
Well, Madam Chair and County Attorney Freeman, I'm concerned about crime in my neighborhoods too. But I know that it really doesn't matter how many we put in prison, because every single one of them will be replaced within 24 hours on the street corner selling, as long as there's somebody buying. We're not going to end the drug trafficking or the crimes involved with it simply by putting more people in prison or putting them in prison longer. It's got to be on the supply end.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I don't necessarily disagree with you. Okay, what we're doing here is we're going to be sending less people to prison without the opportunity of getting the chemical dependency treatment they need to come back out. I think we're going to try to make sure that the diversion programs and 15218s are going to be done. You know, Senator, you're absolutely right. The drug problem has been around a long time. And we saw a lot of downward departures by the courts, which is one of the reasons you all created this task force in the first place. But when we looked and we pushed hard, we had to fight through some of the myths that are out there. What we're trying to do, and I think the package we're giving you will provide that it, more treatment in prison. And we asked, and we recognize you've got a lot of other demands. If we can save some prison beds, you've got to save the money, use it elsewhere. But we asked for some of that, half the money to go to additional treatment programs in prison and half to go back to the counties and the cities to provide for the treatment they folks know. We know one of the results here is Hennepin County is going to have more people, fewer people in prison and more people in our county system, and that's going to cost the county. But if you help us by sending some treatment money back, I think we can do better with them.
Senator Berglund and Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair and Mr. Freeman, I'm not criticizing the report. I guess it's more of a general statement about the way people approach things in government. Because, you know, over the years, where has it been that we've tried to balance a budget? It's been on the part of the budget that provides treatment to people before they get involved in selling or going to prison. And I think it's crazy, and I just have to say so while I get a chance.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Freeman, as far as, well, Mr. Turner said that there we have a savings of $25,000 per bed, so we've got a savings of $2.5 million here. What was the recommendations from Ms. Valkowski as far as treatment? Just looking at the membership here, she's about the only one that could address that, I suppose. And is there a group that's working on this whole area of treatment that we've been talking about? And where would you spend the money? The $2.5 million you're talking about, splitting that up. There's a series of questions there.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. And I think we have Dan Kane, who is a member of that, who is a longtime treatment professional of some strong reputation. Ms. Valkowski was there. Tom Atkins from, you know, Washington County Corrections. I always am tempted to talk about things I know not enough about. This time I will not.
We'll let Dan talk
Sorry.
About them. Okay. All right. Hey. Other questions for Mr. Freeman? If not, we will move to Brock Hunter.
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And thank you to Mr. Brown for providing the giant stack of paper for Mr. Freeman. Mr. Hunter.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brock Hunter. I'm the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I would also like to add that it was an honor to be appointed to this working group. I know I learned a lot over the course of the process, and I think that there was a great deal of value in the discussion that we had. Having said that, I've got to share Mr. Stewart's statement of some frustration over the way that the report ended up coming out. I intended to start my talk by referring to the chart that Senator Latz has already referenced. This is the piece of paper with three charts, two on one side, one on the other. It comes from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission report from January 15th of 2008. Senator Latz got it right. There is a one-way ratchet, it seems, in this area of legislation. And what we see in those charts is just how far out of the norm that we are with other states and as well as with the feds. Within the criminal justice system, the federal court system is notoriously tough on drug offenses. If you look at Figure 5, you see that where it's comparing presumptive sentence lengths for an offender with that sold 10 grams of a hard drug, you get 86 months in Minnesota State Prison, presumptive. In the federal system, you don't even get a year. And I just wanted to highlight that in addition to the other parts of those charts that were already noted, just to show it, Minnesota is really, really out of the norm with other states that both surround us and other states in the country, states like Texas that are notoriously tough. We're just really, really far gone. And I guess I'd like to talk very briefly about how we got there. We each member of the committee was given the opportunity at the beginning to sort of give a brief talk on where we're coming from and where we see the problems in the current system. And what I chose to focus on is just a brief history of drug sentencing laws in Minnesota. And the gist of what I told the working group is that Back in 1989, when the legislature first created the current drug sentencing structure of first through fifth degree offenses, the original thresholds for a first degree possession of hard drug was 500 grams possession, almost a pound, and 50 grams sale. They also created a much lower set of thresholds for crack cocaine. Those were set at 25 grams and 10 grams. This is where we're at right now. And what happened is that there was a Supreme Court decision called State v. Russell, in which the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to have a different set of thresholds for powder cocaine versus crack cocaine, and that we couldn't do that. An opinion, by the way, that the federal government just got around within the last year or so to adopting themselves. So we were 20 years ahead of our time there. The response to the State v. Russell decision was that the legislature lowered all hard drug thresholds down to those of crack cocaine. And so we went from, you know, treating a first degree offender, the original statutory history behind this was that 500 grams was considered the amount that a kingpin, a wholesaler, a drug wholesaler, would have on possession at any given time, and that that kingpin would deal in increments of approximately 50 grams. We now moved moving those thresholds down to making people who possessed 25 grams or sold 10 to be treated as kingpins and sentenced accordingly. And hence, we have all of these, what I do consider to be low-level drug offenders going off to prison for 86 months, when under the old statutory scheme, they probably wouldn't have gone to prison at all. So that's how we got to where we're at right now. And that was what, in my view, we were going to try to address when we sat down at this working group and try to get a fresh look at this and a fresh approach. Now, I'm going to call the committee's attention to the report, and I'm going to call your attention to page 8, which is a table that's attached to the executive summary that shows the various proposals that were made by various groups within this working group. You'll see that the second column over shows the present drug thresholds, as I've just described. The third column over is the law enforcement proposal that Mr. Freeman has just talked about. The fourth column was the defense proposal put forth by John Stewart and I. And our position was that thresholds alone, and I think it's already been noted by members of the committee, do not tell the whole story. Just because a person possesses 10 gram, or 25 grams or sells 10 grams does not make them a kingpin. We wanted to see, if you're looking at just weight alone, a much higher set of thresholds that actually puts you up into the range where it would be a kingpin. We ended up choosing in our proposal thresholds consistent with what we termed the Littman-Ellison bill. Back in 2004, Representatives Littman and Ellison, one of the more conservative members of the House and one of the more liberal members of the House, proposed a bill in response to the Guidelines Commission 2004 drug report that would have raised thresholds to the amounts that Mr. Stewart and I proposed in our proposal. We followed their thresholds, but we added something in, and that was to say that if you could provide some aggravating factors, and Mr. Stewart talked about those, possession of a gun, employing other people, employing kids, etc., that you could still get them on a first degree with the existing current thresholds of 10 and 25 grams. If you could show two or more of those aggravating factors, you could still treat that the existing thresholds as a first degree. But without those aggravating factors, we argued for much higher thresholds. The original vote on the law enforcement proposal went 8-8 and was then defeated. The original vote on the defense proposal went 8-8 and was defeated. At the next meeting, the judges and Mr. Adkins from Washington County Corrections came forward with their own proposal that on this chart is called the third proposal. At our last meeting, we all agreed that this proposal would officially be called the judicial/corrections proposal, and apparently that change didn't get made in these tables. But the three judges on the panel and a probation officer came forward with a compromise proposal. they still had a fairly substantial increase in thresholds. Instead of 250 grams possession, they only went up to 100 grams. And instead of 50 grams sale, they went up to 40 for a first degree. But they included most of the same aggravating factors that we did. And so it was very similar to our proposal in that way. Mr. Stewart and I took a look at that proposal and immediately decided this was something we could live with. And we went with the judges and corrections. To our great disappointment, law enforcement and the folks with them didn't budge an inch. Mr. Freeman indicated that prior to this working group get together, the prosecutors and law enforcement got together over the course of the summer. I believe he indicated during the working group that they met 13 times. And it became apparent over the course of the working group that they had already decided what they were going to do. And there really wasn't any bargaining going on there. Whereas we made concessions throughout the working group, voting for things that we weren't necessarily totally happy with. But we were hoping that if we went with that, there would be some give and take. Our regret coming out of this is that there just really wasn't any give and take. Ultimately, the vote that had tied things at 8-8 switched, and it was 9-7. And that's how we ended up with where we're at. We would ask the committee to take a close look at the judge's proposal. It has a much more substantial bed impact than the proposal that was finally voted through in the working group. And we think that it would accomplish a lot of the things that we really set out to do here. I'd like to just
Mr.
wrap
Hunter,
up.
Okay. Yes. I was going to say, if you could wrap up.
Just a couple of points that I would make. Mr. Freeman talked about, in talking about Statute 152.18 and the Supreme Court's research, talked about that there was a myth of disparity of use of 152.18 across the state. And the basis for that was some phone calls made to some county attorneys around the state. I'm not sure how many, but my impression was that it was maybe a dozen or so. None of those numbers is included in the report. So we're not talking about a scientific rebuttal to the Supreme Court numbers, but pretty much an anecdotal one. I don't know what the true numbers of use of 152.18 are, but I think that it's apparent that the Supreme Court spent a lot of time getting those numbers together, going county by county, and it's a much more complete look of the state's use of 152.18 than anything else that we have. We're not talking about forcing judges to grant 152.18, but just making it presumptive and say, if there's a good reason not to grant it, then so be it, but at least take a look at it. And with respect to marijuana thresholds, Mr. Stewart and I were against raising thresholds for marijuana at all. The legislature set the current thresholds back in the late 80s. Prior to that, thresholds for marijuana were much lower, and people were going to prison in much larger numbers for marijuana offenses than they are now. And I think that there was a collective agreement that that was not an efficient use of law enforcement dollars, that marijuana in the big scheme of things did not pose the public safety risk that harder drugs do, and that more focus should be put on those. Yes, marijuana is stronger than it used to be. I've seen no numbers, no statistics or medical findings in this committee or in this working group that showed that it makes anybody more violent, that it makes anybody more likely to commit a criminal offense. And when we talk about violence associated with marijuana, it may well be that the person happened to have a joint in their pocket when they committed a violent offense. And as I pointed out, they also maybe happened to be wearing a pair of tennis shoes. That does not necessarily mean that the tennis shoes made them more likely to commit the offense. The fact of the matter is that if you lower marijuana thresholds, you're going to increase the value of marijuana on the street. The reason that kids are killing each other over marijuana is because it has a value. It is a rare commodity. Just as they kill each other over sports jackets and tennis shoes and anything else that they might want. By lowering thresholds, you're not going to solve that problem, and quite frankly, you may increase the problem of violence associated. That's really all I've got. Everybody else has already touched on everything.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good summary. Thank you. Questions, Mr. Hunter? Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair.
No, you're Madam Rosen.
That's good. The intent of this today is just information, mm-hmm. and is the legislative body a vote on these recommendations, or
How does this, what are we planning on doing?
To do anything with these recommendations, we would put together a bill and, you know, have a discussion in the Judiciary Committee and then in this committee as well. So this is what I would see as the basis for a bill, and what we decide to put in it or take out of it is
our choice.
Us. Okay. Mr. Kane, come on up to the table. I know that you were telling me yesterday you didn't think you could get here, so I'm glad you did.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Higgins, members of the committee, my name is Dan Kane, C-A-I-N, and I'm the president of R.S. Eden. R.S. Eden is a 38-year-old multidimensional social service program that provides substance abuse treatment, correctional services, electronic monitoring, drug testing, housing, employment. We try to be a one-stop shop to the extent that we can to meet the needs of people who have made poor decisions in their life and have to overcome them. And I want to start out by saying that I'm thankful for the opportunity to be part of the committee and serve. And in some ways, it gives the appearance that there was polarization to the extent that, you know, people had motives, and I always feel uncomfortable with that. Let me say very clearly that I don't think there was a disingenuous bone on anybody's part on this committee, and while people came with different perspectives for what they saw as being the problem and what they saw as being the solutions, that I believe everybody was extremely committed to the issues of public safety and probably secondarily how we could do so, provide public safety in the most efficient way and the most cost-effective way for the citizens of the state of Minnesota. I forgot to mention that I also chaired the Sentencing Commission. I was on the commission from 1982 till 1990, chaired it from 1991, actually, and chaired it from 1986 till 1991. So if there are problems with what happened in 1989, I feel that I have some responsibility there. While you guys passed the laws, we did rank them. So I say that up front. I think this was a very difficult task because people do bring such diverse perspectives and diverse opinions to the issue of drugs, crime. It's very different if you're a law enforcement officer or a community person dealing in the community or a treatment person, depending upon how you identify this issue. But we worked very long and very hard under a very short time frame. And the time frame was made shorter because we took the first 2.5 meetings to gather information from constituent groups that were really already represented on the committee itself. And so that then left us little time to actually go to our work. I will say that in some ways the committee work was exciting and stimulative. Some ways it could be very painful because the perspectives were so diverse. But I did feel it important to send a letter, and I don't know if that was distributed or not, to Senator Higgins and Representative Paim, our respective chairs of the committees, outlining the fact that on most of the most important issues that were decided by this committee were decided on 8-8 votes to fail or 9-7 votes to pass. And I think that it's extreme. I mean, we spent 20 years now doing what we did under 1989 law. And I think it's extremely important for this committee to spend the time to make sure that we get it right this time. Because if we don't, and we spend another 20 years, there are individuals, there are families, there are communities, and there are victims that will, you know, suffer as a result of our inaction. There are a number of things that were presented here, and I'm neither as eloquent as public defender Stewart or as collegial as county attorney Freeman, but I do care very deeply about this issue. Since the beginning, when Tom Johnson and Jim Kamen brought forward the proposal in 1989 to identify where someone fell on the drug hierarchy based upon the amount of drug they possessed or sold, I felt that that was a flawed system. You know, you have people who fall through the cracks in that, and I've raised the issue a number of times. Many of you people may remember a gentleman, that's probably not the right term, a person by the name of Plooky Duke, who was prosecuted as one of the larger drug offenders, drug dealers, drug kingpins, if you will, in the state of Minnesota several years back. Ultimately prosecuted federal and convicted on conspiracy charges. Mr. Duke never carried an amount of drugs sufficient enough to get him past probably fifth-degree possession. You know, on the other hand, his daughter-in-law, who was, I don't want to say that she was naive or unintelligent because she's since gone on, gotten a presidential pardon, and become an attorney. But she had a large amount of drugs, and she was a courier and a mule, and knew very little other than the fact that she loved her husband, and she followed his direction, and she got a very, very serious sentence that was disparate enough that the president at the time saw fit to give her a pardon, and which allowed her to get out of prison and ultimately become an attorney. And all that is kind of editorial rhetoric, but the bottom line is I don't think that, you know, relying solely on the amount of drugs that a person possesses or sells is going to identify how bad they are in terms of where they stand in the overall scheme of things. I believe that the committee was directing us to provide some remedy to that. I also believed that the committee, or that the legislature in appointing the committee was directing us to bring policy in line with practice. And by that, what I'm referring to is the fact that we, with our current drug laws and sentencing scheme, we have better than a 50% departure rate. And most of those departures are downward departures. That means the judges are basically saying to the system that we have in place, this does not work for me. Now, granted, most of those departures, many of them, if not most, take place in the metropolitan area where there are more services, there are more options, there are more alternatives. But, you know, whether or not someone goes to prison or doesn't go to prison should not be dependent upon where they commit their crime. And I think that we have a system right now that unfortunately too often does result in that. There are a number of things. I voted for the judicial proposal. Let me make that clear up front. And I don't want to seem disingenuous and be back here looking for a do-over. And I was part of the committee. You have the committee report in front of you. And that's the report that was voted on by the majority of the people that sat at this table and for eight different meetings. However, I think that given the fact that the split in votes were so close, and I have to say, you know, one of the things that is probably a highlight of my career was working on the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission when they were first put together, because I saw people put aside their respective positions in the system and say to themselves, we have to give, we have to take, because this is all about the common good. And I'm struck by the fact of former Chief Justice Amdahl, who's somewhat ill now and has some problems and whatever, but he was one of the architects of this. And at one meeting, he actually voted a particular way, and all the other people on the commission looked at him and said, you know, what in the heck are you doing? And he said, well, I felt I had to vote as a judge at least once to maintain my constituency. And that was the spirit in which it took place. I don't think we reached that here, and I don't think we could have because of the time frame that we had. So what I'm asking is that this group do two things. One, if you're going to take action, review both the proposal in the report and the judicial proposal, because I think that they both got enough support from the members to have consideration, depending upon what your perspective is, because in the end, your perspective is more important than ours. The other thing that I would ask is on 15218, That failed on a tie vote. And, you know, whether or not Ms. Lawrence's information is accurate or the information gathered by County Attorney Freeman and others is accurate needs to be determined, because I think that that vote resulted in a tie because there was confusion. There were conflicting reports. There were conflicting numbers. Obviously, if you have two counties right next to each other, one of which has 30 people sentenced under 15218, the other which has zero people under 15218, then that's a problem. On the other hand, if those aren't the accurate figures, I think we need to know that more than what we get in terms of somebody talked to somebody and brought back information. So I'd ask that you gather that information accurately from both sources, weigh it, evaluate it, and make your determination based on that. A couple other things that I would add. First off, in response to Senator Rosen's question, or may have been Senator Scheid's question, regarding the amount of drugs that a person could use. That's a subjective determination based upon the purity of the drug. And there's a wide range of purity that exists out there. It's not uncommon for a heavy user to use a full gram a day of relatively high purity drugs. It's you lower the purity. There are people who use 2 grams a day. And what we do in our laws is we don't take into consideration purity. We do say that a substance containing an amount of a particular drug. And in our deliberations, one of the things that I thought was particularly funny, and I'll share it with you and then stop with the editorial stuff, is, you know, Senator Neville, or Judge Neville, I apologize, he told a story about a case that had come before him where they tried to prosecute it at a higher level of dosage based upon the THC that was in the water of a water pipe. And he threw it out. The county attorney's actually appealing it, as I understand it. I may be wrong on that. But it is the case that any amount of, I mean, if I put 1 grain of a drug in a packet of sugar that weighs a gram, that's a gram of drug. So, again, the amount that a person can use is dependent upon the purity, but it's not uncommon to use a gram a day or 2 grams a day of lesser purity drug. So, consequently, 10 grams is what one person, depending upon purity, would use in 5 to 10 days. 25 grams, the possession threshold, again, 12 to 25 days. That does not make someone a kingpin. Now, again, I understood that we were looking for a kingpin. That may not have been the thing that the legislature was directing us. Obviously, the majority of the group did not agree with that. But we did add modifiers, and we added modifiers to all 3 proposals that would identify behavior in addition to the amount of drug that a person possessed or sold, things like they employed more than 3 people. They sold on more than 3 occasions. They carried a gun. They used children. And again, you can argue whether the level of sophistication there is based upon the fact that they know that the children fall under the juvenile justice system and consequently will not be punished as heavily, or they use their children because they had them available. But regardless, we agreed that that group should be a higher level, that that would fall under the level of kingpin. We also talked, although we didn't, it never got to a vote, about the possibility of adding a modifier that would reference the level of vulnerability of the community. I mean, obviously, 10 grams of a drug in Minneapolis is much different than 10 grams of a drug in Thief River Falls. And the person that is using or selling or in possession of that is going to be, you know, he's going to be making a bigger impact on the community up there than he might down here. So we did add that as a modifier, or we didn't. We talked about it as a modifier. I would just ask that this committee, in its deliberations before passing things, weigh all of the information in the report. Look at all the proposals, although I think really the defense proposal was compromised with the agreement of the people that were in defense in favor of the judicial proposal. Look at those 2 proposals and look at any area where we failed on an 8-8 vote or passed on a 9-7 vote, because this is too important of a thing moving forward, particularly given its potential lasting effects, to get wrong. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Cain? Well, thanks to everyone who was here today. You all did an amazing amount of work, and we are very appreciative of you taking the time and the effort to put these recommendations together. There is not a bill at this point, members. If there are anybody who wants to take it and run with it, let us know. Mr. Backus will have his hands full trying to put it all together in whatever fashion that anybody wants to work with. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank you for allowing me to be the ex officio on this particular committee. I apologize to the committee for not being there any more often than I was, but they did do an awful lot of work, a lot of great work. The citizen input was wonderful. I thought law enforcement was a presence there. So I thank the committee. The question I have is there was an awful lot of talk about discussing more of these documents and more things. At least that's the gist of it. Are we going to have more meetings at all, or are we just going to deal with bills as they come? Or
we can do whatever we want because it's our committee and we've got 5 months.
Yeah, the point I'm making is that when we deal with...
You're going to keep me prisoner here for 5 months?
Yep.
When we deal...
I didn't take any dope.
Madam Chair, when we deal with issues in any part of government, we have the actual folks that, all the folks here, and I guess if we're going to do that, I would certainly like to see the task force involved here,
sure.
Give everybody at least a little better idea of what that teaspoon does mean and how often I see that out there. Those are the folks that are really working on the road, and of course, the prosecutors and defense attorneys take it from there, but where the rubber meets the road, I'd like to have that discussion too.
Okay. I think we would probably start the discussion in Senator Mois' committee because the policy goes along first and then we figure out how to pay for it. I think that's kind of how we're supposed to do it. Any other comments? Any other questions? Thank you all. And we are adjourned. We are not meeting on... Oh, yes, on the agenda, it says the Judiciary Committee will meet next. That would be tomorrow. And we're in the State Office Building tomorrow. We have a joint hearing with our companion committee from the House, and the next Public Safety Budget Division hearing will be next Wednesday, a week from today. We are adjourned.